We live, don't we, in extraordinary times. Our days are indeed the last days. And how is it that we're able to say that with such a degree of confidence? It's because we've been given the more sure word of prophecy. A word of prophecy which is able to be a light for us in this dark world. And so that's why, with absolute confidence, we are able to say that we live in the last days. Ours are the days when we're watching this looming shadow of the King of the North over the territory, particularly of the Middle East. We're seeing headlines like this. Our study this morning is going to focus particularly on, of course, Russia, but particularly around the last few months of the events that we've seen taking place in the world. The Russian shadow falls over Syria as Kurds open door for Assad. We've seen headlines like this. Is Putin the new king of the Middle East? What an extraordinary headline just 3 or 4 months ago. Putin, the Wall Street Journal reported, is the new king of Syria. And so how do we make sense of these things when we see these headlines being thrown up in front of us across the world? Where do we turn to understand what it is that's taking place? Well, we turn, don't we, to the more sure word of prophecy. We've just read Daniel chapter 11. I think we've all got our Bibles there. Keep a marker, but come to Ezekiel 38. Just coming back a few pages or so, where we're given, aren't we, the parallel passage to Daniel chapter 11. And when we do just some very basic study, we very quickly see that these two passages, particularly the end of Daniel chapter 11, from verse 40 to the end of the chapter that we read together, and Ezekiel chapter 38, are talking of the same superpower. Gog of the land of Magog is talking of the king of the north. And just on the screen there, we certainly won't go through them. We can see some of the passages, we'll look at a few more shortly, that link these two great chapters. But what we're starting to see when we look at the world today is the separating of the nations described for us here in Ezekiel chapter 38. So we read, don't we, in verse 2 of Gog of the land of Magog. We'll look at why we believe that's Russia very shortly. Meshech and Tubal. Behold, I'm against thee, O Gog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. And this superpower is going to come, verse 5, with Persia. We understand that that's modern-day Iran, don't we? So Gog of the land of Magog, Russia, will come with Iran and also with Ethiopia. We actually understand that to be more the sort of Horn of Africa territory, which would include Ethiopia. In addition, Libya, that's not too difficult for us. In verse 6, we read of European powers, of Goma. We think of that as sort of northern France, Germany. Perhaps we'll put some of these on a map to just help us out. This is where we think that these nations are in the world today. But we also notice, don't we, that on the opposite side, if you like, to these, and it's not about goodies or baddies. I'm a primary school teacher, and my mindset naturally just goes goodies and baddies, right? But it's not actually about that at all. You know, clearly, when men are concerned, frankly, it's all bad. But what we see is an aggressor in the King of the North coming against the mountains of Israel. And we see in verse 13, Sheba and Dedan, we're talking the sort of Gulf states there, and the merchants of Tarshish. Well, we've done lots on that, haven't we, in the last few years. We understand, don't we, that that's talking to us of Britain. There was an article yesterday, which I haven't put on the screen, in the Express, talking about how that Britain is beginning to make really strong relationships with the Commonwealth in order for her to trade effectively, which is exactly what we'd expect, of course, to see. So we're seeing, aren't we, the, if you like, the separation of these nations, Tarshish and Sheba and Dedan, and then on another side, Gog of the land of Magog, confederate with European powers and Iran and Ethiopia and Libya. And it's unreasonable, isn't it, when we've got friends perhaps who are interested in these things, but without necessarily the knowledge that many of us will have had over many of years of looking at this, to just say we think Gog of the land of Magog is Russia. We understand it because the first century historians tell us that's the territory of Russia. So Josephus said that the Jews of his age in the first century recognized Magog as the territory of the Scythians. Now, the Scythian territory is there on the screen, and you'll be able to see particularly a little peninsula sticking out from the Scythian territory, which helps us identify it, of course. What you've got there is some of Russia, you've got some of eastern Ukraine, including, of course, the Crimea, which we've seen Russia dropping into, haven't we, in recent times. This is another historian, a geographer as well, Herodotus, who drew this map just sort of 100 years or so after Ezekiel was prophesying. And, you know, I think it's extraordinary. You think, you know, we benefit today, don't we, from Google Maps. How on earth was he able to draw something so amazing, really, that describes, look at Europa going across the top, this sort of superpower going across the top. We see, of course, Iran and Libya. And we've also put on there these eight rivers, which is the rivers they identified the Scythians with. And if you look carefully, just below the word Europa, you'll see Scythia and the eight rivers. That's the Magogite territory, including the Crimea, eastern Ukraine, which Russia currently sits in. So we read here that the scholars talking to us about Magog, telling us it's this Scythian territory. A scholar that many of us know very well, of course, Brother Thomas, talks of the fact that Ross is the most ancient form under which history makes mention of the name of Russia. Rus, also spelled Ross, the Encyclopedia Britannica tells us, are the ancient people who gave their name to the lands of Russia and Belarus. So this superpower, Gog of the land of Magog, we shouldn't be in any doubt, it is Russia. And Russia are going to come confederate with other nations onto the mountains of Israel. And we've seen these sorts of headlines, haven't we? Of Putin being the new king in Syria, in that King of the North territory. Brother Thomas, writing 150 years ago or so, in the preface to Elpis Israel, wrote this. The future movements of Russia are notable signs of the times, because they're predicted in the scriptures of truth. The Russian autocracy, in its plenitude, on the verge of its dissolution, is the image of Nebuchadnezzar standing on the mountains of Israel, ready to be smitten by the stone. When Russia makes its grand move for the building up of its image empire, then let the reader know that the end of all things, as at present constituted, is at hand. Surely we're seeing, aren't we, Russia beginning to build up its great empire. We're beginning to see Nebuchadnezzar's image stand on its feet. Now, in order for us to really grasp what's going on, we need to do a very brief Sunday school lesson to remind ourselves of how it is that the King of the North, Russia, fits so well with the prophecy of Daniel. I've put on the screen here a table that's been adapted actually from the Christadelphian Expositor, which is helpful in showing us the build-up from Daniel chapter 2 to chapter 7, to chapter 8, to chapter 11. And for us to understand that what we see in each of those prophecies is building on the last and is very much in tandem. So Daniel chapter 2, you remember, is talking to us of the great power of Babylon. Babylon was the head of gold, and the chest and arms of silver were the Medes and the Persians. The belly and thighs of brass were the Greeks, and the legs of iron were the Romans. And when we come to Daniel chapter 7, well, we see the same thing. We see that the image of the lion with two eagle's wings is talking to us of Babylon. Then we see the bear raised up on its side with three ribs in its mouth. It's talking of the Medes and the Persians. Then we see, don't we, the leopard with four wings, the Greek Empire moving at great pace before it splits into four. Then we see the great and terrible beast treading down the others, the one of Rome with iron teeth, fitting with the iron legs of the Roman territory. Then we come to Daniel chapter 8, and in Daniel chapter 8, we see, don't we, the ram with two horns, the Medo-Persian Empire. We see the goat moving at great pace, the Greek Empire. And we'll come a little later to see the end of Daniel chapter 8. And we come to Daniel chapter 11. Will you turn there for me, please? And we see these things being built on again. So in verse 2, we see the Persians. At the end of verse 2, we've got the Greeks. And from the Greeks, a mighty king would stand up. That mighty king, of course, is Alexander the Great. He'll rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken and shall be divided toward the four winds. After Alexander died, his four generals took over the kingdom. There they are on the screen for us, or their territories. That fits, doesn't it, with the leopard and the four wings we see in Daniel chapter 7. And then the rest of Daniel chapter 11 is set up to show the most extraordinary history and to tell us of the king of the north and the king of the south. And very simply, the king of the north is always the superpower sitting above the territory of Israel, and the king of the south is always the king sitting below Israel. So whoever occupies this territory, this of course is Egypt, isn't it, this territory here today, whoever's sitting there is the king of the south, and whoever's sitting here is the king of the north. And it's set up like that for us to understand clearly who these people are. What we then see is a jump in verse 40 of Daniel chapter 11, where we're asked to move to the time of the end. Now, our time doesn't allow us, but actually from verse 36 to verse 39, we read of a king. And it's not the king of the north or the king of the south, because it's the Roman king who, of course, was over all of that territory of the king of the north and the king of the south. But we then read in verse 40, at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him. So who is the king of the south pushing at? Well, the king of the south is going to be pushing at whoever is sitting in that territory. We'll come to it shortly. I want you to just see on the screen here that the person we read of, Gog of the land of Magog in Ezekiel 38, is the king of the north of Daniel chapter 11. It's also building on the image of Nebuchadnezzar's dream of Daniel chapter 2. When Rome, of course, divides, and you've got Western and Eastern Rome, and unsurprisingly, we would expect it to be Eastern Rome, because Eastern Rome lasts so much longer. It's also the dragon power that we'll come to in Revelation. This is who we're referring to when we talk now of the king of the north from the time of the end in Daniel chapter 11. Just as a quick reminder for us, here are these territories that we see in Daniel chapter 2. These are the empires that come and go. And we notice particularly that the legs of iron, the western part of Rome, collapsed in the year 476 when the barbarian Odoacer came into the Roman territory and took it. But Rome lived on. And this is absolutely essential to our understanding of these things this morning. Rome lived on. The empire that Nebuchadnezzar saw in his dream and Daniel explained to him was split into two. The eastern leg didn't fall for another 1,000 years or so. In the year 1453, when Constantinople was taken by the Turks, the Ottoman Turks, that Muslim nation who came in, and so Constantinople collapsed. That's absolutely essential for us because it helps us understand what Daniel 11 and verse 40 is really talking to us about. At the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him. Well, him we naturally think of, don't we, as, well, the king of the north. But Rome fell in 476. No, it didn't fall. It went over to Constantinople. But that fell in 1453. So when we read at the time of the end, does that include 1453? No. Who took over Constantinople in 1453? It was the Ottoman Turk. So the king of the south, whoever's occupying Egypt, will push at him, the Ottoman Turk, sitting. Where are they sitting? Well, their empire was so great, it sat, of course, in Israel, including Jerusalem. And rather amazingly, just over a century or so ago now, the king of the south, just for a short period of time, was Britain. The history books tell us that Britain occupied Egypt from 1888 to 1922, or 1882 to 1922. 40 years. Britain occupied Egypt. And what did Britain do? Well, you know this, don't you? At the end of the First World War, General Allenby marched into Jerusalem. And as he did so in 1917, he pushed out the Ottoman Turk. The Cambridge History of Egypt tells us that from 1882 to 1922, Britain occupied Egypt. And so just over 100 years or so, we saw part of the final, not quite the final, we'll see there's a bit to come, but part of the final push of the drying up of the Ottoman Empire. The empire that was sitting there in the King of the North territory, it had sat through the King of the South as well, but it had been pushed out all the way back to Turkey. And we understand, don't we, from Revelation chapter 16, that when the sixth angel pours out his vial, and this is leading up to the events of Armageddon, he pours out his vial on the great river Euphrates, and the water was dried up. And we know, don't we, that the Euphrates talks to us of the Turkish Empire. Why? Because the river Euphrates begins in Turkey. So when the river dries up, it dries up to its source, doesn't it? And so we're seeing, or we've seen in history, part of the major decline of the Ottoman Empire. We've seen then, look at this, Daniel 11, verse 40. At the time of the end, shall the king of the south, we believe that that was Britain in 1917, if we're making a note, shall push at him. We believe that that was the Ottomans, because the Ottomans were sitting in that territory. And the king of the north shall come against him. Who's the him? It's the Ottomans. It's the Turks. The king of the north shall come against him. Turkey, like a whirlwind, with chariots, with horsemen, and with many ships. And brethren, sisters, and young people, that hasn't happened yet. So we found ourselves in history. We found ourselves in this great prophetic book. We are halfway through, if you like, Daniel 11 and verse 40, which ties so beautifully, of course, in with Revelation 16, with the drying up of the great river Euphrates. Now, let's just build on this a little more, because it is of great significance that we understand that Rome moved to Constantinople. When the Roman Empire collapsed, the Christianized Rome took itself to the Byzantine Empire, whose capital was Constantinople. And that didn't fall until 1453. And of course, Constantinople is modern-day Istanbul. And you may be interested to note that Istanbul, and you could say, well, Pete, so are many other cities in the world, but Istanbul is known for the fact it is built on seven hills. Now, we know, don't we, that that's one of the identifiers of Rome from Revelation chapter 17. When we read Revelation 17, we're told, aren't we, that the seven heads of the beast are seven hills, and we identify it with Rome. In fact, Istanbul, they say, when you read this website, and I can just about read it here, it says, the ancient Constantinople was founded on seven hills, surrounded by the city walls, just like old Rome. So, they know that this city we're supposed to identify with Rome. But of course it fell. It fell in 1450, hundreds of years ago. 1453, Constantinople falls. And the Turks sit there. And the Turks are nothing to do with Rome, because they are Muslim as a nation. They're described for us, aren't they, in Revelation chapter 9, which ends with the fall of Constantinople. So what happens to Rome? Well, the Eastern Orthodox Church, with Roman roots that's been sitting in Constantinople, moves. And it's why Russians call Moscow the Third Rome. Just to read this, just to give a bit of history for it, we see, here we are, the Orthodox monk, his name is on the screen, who called Moscow the Third Rome for the first time in 1523 to 1524, so before the fall of Constantinople, but watching these things taking place, two Romes fell, a third stands, there will not be a fourth. And he goes on to explain that Constantinople became the second Rome, the capital of the truly Christian world. In 1453, the Ottoman Empire conquered Constantinople, weakened by political crisis, and renamed it in Istanbul. Moscow, which in the 15th to 16th centuries gathered around itself the fragmented Russian lands, became the main Orthodox Christian capital. So we see today that this is Turkey. It's 98% Muslim as a nation. And of course, in Russia, it's the Eastern Orthodox Church. It's Rome, you see, that is sitting in Moscow today. Which is why we've been so fascinated in the last month or so to see Putin up to his old tricks, where he's changing the constitution again, isn't he, to make sure that he doesn't have to leave power. And what is he being described as by the political commentators? Like the SARS. All right? Think of the SARS. This is derived from the word Caesar, which of course we know to be Roman. Vladimir Putin follows a long Russian tradition of enlightened autocrats. Trump's disgrace in the Middle East, of course, they're furious because Donald Trump has removed as much as he possibly can American troops from the Syrian territory, which, of course, the West is not happy about because it gives Putin all of the power in that territory. Vladimir Putin, they say, is Caesar now. This is from The Independent on the 17th of October, just last year. Tyrant he may be, talking of Putin, of course, but at least he's sane. And he guesses who he's talking about there, right? His legions stayed out of the war in Syria and saved the Assad regime. They cleared the highways of ISIS mines. They restored the roads, sometimes incredibly what were once Roman roads, and they learned Arabic. Perhaps, indeed, Putin now plays the role of the latter Roman Empire of the East, the Christian one which survived in Constantinople, Byzantium, Istanbul for hundreds more years after the fall of Rome itself. All the Middle East is now his empire, every capital welcoming the emperor. That is an extraordinary article that sets out what Brother Thomas, what Christadelphians for hundreds of years have believed. And we're seeing it in just the last few months. Putin, the Tsar, is more dangerous than ever, they say. Why do they say that? Vladimir Putin will be the Tsar of all the Russians for another decade and more. The question for the US and its global allies is clear. What does this mean for Russian grand strategy? How can they construct a modus vivendi with Putin and Russia? It goes on to say, look also for Putin to consolidate his recent gains in the Middle East. With the advantage of a lengthened timeline, he'll probably approach Iran. Well, that seems to fit in, doesn't it? That's exactly what we would expect from our reading of Ezekiel 38. Or to mediate his feud with the West on terms that will be helpful to Russia in terms of oil flows. We'll come to that shortly. So, we ask ourselves then, well, what of Nebuchadnezzar's image? What of that image that was to stand on the mountains of Israel? When the stone cut out of the mountain without hands crashes into that image, it's not that all that's there are the feet, part of iron, part of clay. The image is stood up, and the whole lot comes crashing down. How is this image going to stand up? If you're sort of on your knees, if you like, sitting down, you try to stand up on one leg, it's jolly hard. It's not easy just for the eastern side to stand. It needs the western side to stand. And they need to stand together for the empire to be stood on its feet. Well, we've seen, haven't we, this last year, Putin meets Pope as relations thaw between Russia and the Vatican, between the East and the West. President Putin meets Pope Francis for a third time. Pope Francis is quietly paving the road to unity. Could the reunion between Catholics and Orthodox be closer than we thought? This is what we'd expect, brethren and sisters and young people, to see. But we're particularly interested in the characteristics of this King of the North, of Russia. And we understand from Revelation chapter 12, where we read of the dragon power, the eastern leg, we read of the dragon power that the dragon power is a great deceiver. It's associated with sin and the serpent. I want you to note, it's the great deceiver. Of course, we've seen that it's Roman in its roots, right? So when we read 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, and we read of the man of sin, which of course we understand to be Rome and the papacy and the Pope, but we're not surprised to see some of the characteristics of that man in Russia, because it's got Roman roots. And of course, in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, the Thessalonians are told to not be deceived by that man of sin. Will you turn back to Daniel chapter 8? So we did, didn't we, a whistle-stop tour of Daniel. We looked at chapter 2, chapter 7, chapter 8. And chapter 8 was talking, wasn't it, of the ram with the two horns and the goat that moves so quickly, the Greek Empire. But we go on, verse 21 of Daniel chapter 8, to read the rough goat is the king of Greece, and the great horn that's between his eyes is the first king, Alexander. Now that being broken, whereas four stood up for it, four kingdoms shall stand up for that nation, but not in his power. So we understand that it broke up to the four generals. In the latter time of their kingdom, we saw in Daniel 11, didn't we, this jump, the time of the end. In the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. So we expect a fierce king to stand up. Now we only read of a fierce king in one other place in Scripture. Many of you will know, I'm sure you'll have a marker in your margin, and it's in Isaiah. I don't want us to go there yet. If we have time, we'll go there later. But you will know that the fierce king of Isaiah 19 sits where? In which territory? In Egypt. All right? Now that's critical to us understanding that this fierce king, this Roman king of origin, is going to sit in Egypt. If we have time, we'll go there later. Verse 24, his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. He shall destroy wonderfully and shall prosper in practice. He shall destroy the mighty and the holy people. So this king is going to destroy the people of Israel, the Jewish people. And through his policy also, he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand. He shall magnify himself in his heart, and by peace shall destroy many. So this king is crafty. That word is elsewhere translated in the Hebrew, deceitful. Perhaps make a note. This is a deceitful king. This is what we'd expect from the dragon power of Revelation 12. It's what we'd expect from the man of Roman origins, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. This king is a deceiver. He's crafty, and he's going to deceive many. But part of his strategy is that he'll do so by peace. That's how he's going to destroy many, in a corrupt manner, by peace. Now, when we apply this to the latter day King of the North, when, of course, we sit these chapters, Daniel 2, Daniel 7, Daniel 8, Daniel 11, we sit them all on top of each other. Here we are now with Russia, the king of the north, who is going to deceitfully and by peace destroy many. So what do we see today? Well, Russia has a policy of deception and denial. Russian propaganda, a multitude of lies and absurd news. Russian brazen lies, The Guardian reported in September, mock the world. How best, they say, to fight for truth, the irony. Russia is playing with the West's mind, says Putin advisor. This is their strategy. The public need a lesson in Russian strategic deception. It's what you want to hear. In 2015, so don't worry, we're not going further back than this. You remember when Russia went into eastern Ukraine, there were many headlines like this, including this one from the BBC, how Russia outfoxes its enemies. And they talked to us about the Russian strategy of Maskirovka. Of course, we get our word, don't we? Masquerade, or to mask something. This idea of hiding the real truth, of being deceitful. The Russians are known for having a military strategy of Maskirovka. Now, I'd like to just play you a very short video explaining this.
Maskirovka began as a Russian military strategy 600 years ago. The Russian Imperial Army was famous for its surprise attacks. During the Second World War, the Soviets' Red Army deployed fake tanks and sent entire divisions in false directions to confuse the Nazis. One of the most recent examples of Maskirovka, Russia's annexation of Crimea and invasion of eastern Ukraine. Remember these guys? The so-called Little Green Men, more than 1,000 Russian forces who claimed to be patriotic volunteers in Crimea on a holiday.
Well, that was a perfect example of Maskirovka, keeping the surrounding countries in some sort of doubt of as to what was going on until the point when the military operation had been completed.
After the annexation of Crimea, analyst Julian Lindley French briefed NATO leaders on the rise of what he calls strategic Maskirovka.
It's designed quite simply to keep adversaries permanently off balance, guessing what Moscow really intends, what it's trying to achieve.
So this Russian strategy of Maskirovka, let me give you an example of it. When the Russians were moving into eastern Ukraine, they lined up on the borders of Ukraine white vans, white lorries, trucks. And these trucks were Russian army trucks, but they'd painted them white. But anyone with half a brain looking at these trucks could see the camouflage through the white. They'd only done one coat job, right? So all of the Western journalists said, these aren't aid vehicles. Absolutely not. These are Russian military vehicles. They're taking arms into Ukraine. And so every Western journalist from here to New Zealand descended on eastern Ukraine and followed these trucks. All the while, just a few miles down the road, the Russians passed huge armaments to their fighters in Ukraine. And when, of course, the aid vehicles got opened, there was nothing in them. That was a classic example of the Russian military strategy of Maskirovka. Another may be when the Russians went into Crimea. And they went into Crimea, and there seemed to be lots of men walking around in green suits, in green boiler suits. And the observant of Crimea said, there seems to be rather a lot of chaps here wearing green boiler suits. Something's not entirely right. And the Western journalists asked maybe a couple of questions. No, don't worry, you know, we're here on holiday, nothing to worry about. And when the signal came, the green came off, and there were the Russian soldiers saying to the Ukrainians in Crimea, this is now ours. That was another classic example of Maskirovka. This nation that historically, by the way, for hundreds of years, has been known for this military strategy of Maskirovka, of deceiving others. So work has been done by think tanks to try to work out what it is that Russia's wanting to do. Putin's Russia is exploiting the weakness of liberal Europe. Russia's order today can best be understood as a form of postmodern absolutism. Hence, postmodern absolutism relies on coercion of the masses than on their manipulation. There's articles being written, distract, deceive, destroy. Except the fact, this article says, that Russia has opted for geopolitical confrontation, its behaviour in Crimea, its efforts to distract, deceive and destroy in Syria show clearly that it's no longer content to play second fiddle in the international ensemble. It wants to play its own leading role. Look at these words, distract, deceive, destroy. What's he going to do, verse 25? Through his policy he shall cause craft, that's our word, deceive, to prosper in his hand, he shall magnify himself in his heart, and by peace shall destroy many. Vladimir Putin's great deceit, the Jerusalem Post reported. The London School of Economics this summer decided to write a paper on this to try to understand what it is that's taking place. It was called The Weaponization of Postmodernism, Russia's New War with Europe. So just in the last 6 months or so, the London School of Economics have written this paper to try to understand Russia's strategy. And I'm going to give you a few extracts from it. The annexation of Crimea in 2014 brought into focus a conflict between Russia and the EU that had been boiling beneath the surface of European public consciousness for some time, in what was called a cold peace. The term cold peace, note the language being used, refers to a situation in which the underlying tensions and conflicts characteristic of a cold war are present, but where these conditions and strategies that go along with them are concealed under the rhetoric of peace. Look at verse 25, right? By peace, he'll destroy many. It goes on to say, applied postmodernism, as it's practiced by Russia, has two features. The first is an attempt to promote a sense of epistemic insecurity amongst targeted populations by undermining existing bonds of trust between them. So what they try to do is send out propaganda to undermine the bonds of trust between nations and peoples. The second is the promotion of alternative or anti-hegemonic perspectives or narratives, especially those in line with Russia's foreign policy objectives. So they put out alternative facts. That's what they do. The Putin regime feels vulnerable to the potentially disruptive spread of European values and ways of thinking about the world. In response, it's lashed out, striking at the heart of the European mind with a weaponized scepticism, standing ready to pick up the pieces with a set of alternative perspectives. The ultimate aim of all this, as I explained above, is the creation of a new world order. Last bit from this article. Post-structuralism severed the ties between empirical fact and language and replaced truth with truths. You see, the world wants postmodernism. It wants to say, you have your truth and I'll have mine. And I tell you what, don't worry too much about it. We're seeing, aren't we, in the last decade, that of course it does not work. You've got to have truth. Truth is absolute. But Russia, the dragon power, the great deceiver, has thought, how can we use this foolish mindset of the West, this love of a postmodern world in which you can have your truth and I'll have mine? We'll use that, and we'll use it to promote our own gains. And so what they do is they put out alternative narratives. They don't just say, if they're accused of, say, bombing in Syria, for example, they wouldn't simply say, no, we didn't do it. What they would do is put out all sorts of news stories across the globe. And at the end of the day, most people go, well, I don't know which one to believe, really. And they get away with it. The dragon power is the great deceiver. This article has been recently written, The Art of Deceit, How China and Russia Use Power to Subvert the West. Just recently, Facebook removes foreign interference operations from Iran and Russia. That's just in the last week or so. because they're constantly using this postmodern nonsense world to put out their own deceptive facts. This week, Russia denies spreading US conspiracy on social media. They're always, always at it. But it's exactly what we would expect to see from the King of the North, from this King of the time of the end, here in Daniel chapter 8. And so we're interested to see the recent moves of this deceitful dragon. And we're seeing, aren't we, how that because of Britain leaving Europe, Russia is being able to cozy up more to the European nations. There's been a thaw this year in EU-Russia relations. Emmanuel Macron, really the leader of Europe, pivot to Russia sparks EU unease. He's looking to Russia. The Germans, this is the Times on November just last year, rebuff the US and seek closer ties with Russia. Who is this? France, Germany. This is Gomer, who we expect to be confederate with Gog of the land of Magog. Europe distancing itself from the US while moving closer to Russia. Europe can be stronger with Russia, claims Moldova's president. We're moving into just this month, this week. Macron defends closer dialogue with Russia. He sees no alternative. So, exactly as we would expect from Ezekiel 38, Gog of the land of Magog is pulling closer to the European nations, or perhaps rather, the European nations are pulling to the King of the North, to Gog. This deceitful dragon has very recently been working in nations beyond Europe. Just turn to Daniel chapter 11. We understand, don't we, from both Ezekiel 38 and Daniel 11, that the King of the North, Gog, as well as being confederate with the European powers, will also be confederate with African nations. He will have power over the treasures of gold and silver, verse 43, over all the precious things of Egypt. Now that's interesting, because the ferocious king of Daniel chapter 8 that we see in Isaiah 19 goes into Egypt. Here in Daniel 11 we see him in Egypt, and in addition we also see the Libyans and the Ethiopians. They were those in Ezekiel 38 as well. They're for us on the screen. We'll be with him. And brethren and sisters, young people, friends, we wonder that here as we are towards the very end of this chapter, that we've seen in the last few months some of the final pieces of the jigsaw being put together. As in the autumn, we saw Russia more extensively than ever before working with African nations. Russia is expanding its strategic influence in Africa. Could Libya be Russia's new Syria? They've asked just in the last couple of months. Russia's growing intervention in the Libyan civil war. Russia opposes any foreign intervention in Sudan. What's Sudan? That's the Horn of Africa territory. When we read of Kush or Ethiopia, we're talking, in addition to Ethiopia, of the Sudan. Why Russia is standing by Sudan's Bashir. Russia deepens its presence in the Sudan. Russia reveals deal, allowing it to use Sudan's ports. Now that's interesting to us, isn't it? We're in Daniel 11, aren't we? In verse 40, what is one of the characteristics of the King of the North? Halfway through the verse, and the King of the North shall come against him. We understand that that's the Ottoman Turk. Like a whirlwind with chariots, with horsemen, and with many ships. Well, no wonder they want these water ports. Are the Russians, this is this summer, forging an empire this, apologies, January, in Africa. In at the end of October, they held an economic forum between Russia and African nations. Russia turns on the charm at first Africa summit. Russia's scramble for Africa. Putin-linked mercenaries are fighting on Libya's front lines. Russia vows to forgive Ethiopia's debts amid growing push for influence in Africa. Russian snipers, missiles and warplanes try to tilt the Libyan war. Russia's growing interest in Libya. Russia exerts growing influence in Africa, worrying many in the West. What do they say? Moscow is taking initial steps towards building a military port in the Horn of Africa that could become Russia's permanent base on the continent there. And it talks of hundreds of Russian fighters in recent months arriving in Libya. Listen, we've just whipped through 20-odd headlines, haven't we? The point in whipping through them is we can just see clearly. Every news outlet across the world is telling us that Russia is working in Libya, in Ethiopia, in Sudan, in other African nations. But they're the ones that we're interested in from Ezekiel 38 and Daniel chapter 11. That the king of the north, who we would expect at the time of the end to be working with these nations, is today working with these nations. But we know that the penultimate move of the king of the north, before it drops down onto the mountains of Israel, verse 41, before it comes entering into the glorious land, Israel, what does it need to have done? The beginning of verse 40. The time of the end shall the king of the south push at him. Tick. Done. And the king of the north shall come against him. Turkey. What is it that we've seen this week? What have we been watching in recent months? We've been seeing the final drying up of the Ottoman Empire. Because the final drying up will see the dragon power, the eastern leg of Nebuchadnezzar's image, move. And it will move from Moscow and drop into Constantinople. And it will begin to stand. It will talk with Rome. And together they will talk and they will stand. And the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet will communicate. They will send out frog-like spirits. And it will draw the nations to Armageddon. And the dragon power will be sitting in Turkey. Turkey and Russia are bitter frenemies. Turkey expands gas exploration efforts to Libya's offshore waters. You can imagine, someone won't be happy with that. In Kiev, Turkey's Erdogan denounces Russia's illegitimate annexation of Crimea. I think this is years ago. He did this month. On the 3rd of February, Erdogan calls Putin out to the world, telling the world that, of course, he should never have gone into the Crimea. What a foolish thing to do. Erdogan accuses Russia of negligence while signing military aid deal with Russia. Turkish president shouts Ukrainian slogan that rankles Russia. Erdogan is calling things out at an official ceremony about Russia. No wonder they're saying this. Erdogan, the headline writers, has lost the plot. They can't believe that this president of Turkey is saying these things about Putin. Russia and Turkey have fallen out in Syria. Escalation in Syria and Libya tests the limits of the Erdogan-Putin ties. Russia, Turkey, Iran reassert their glory of past empires in today's Middle East. Turkey edges towards direct conflict with Russian-backed Syria. Turkey and Russia fight it out. Is this the end of the road for Erdogan? Listen, this isn't Christadelphian saying this, is it? This is the news outlets of the world asking, is this the end of the world for Erdogan? Because they understand that Russia will not put up with such rhetoric. Just yesterday, 33 Turkish troops killed in airstrike in northern Syria. The BBC tells us that the Syrian forces fighting there are supported by Russia, who are trying to retake Idlib from rebels who are backed by Turkish soldiers. 33 Turkish troops killed yesterday. Most people feel that it's highly likely that these airstrikes on Syrian territory were likely coordinated by Russia. They're asking, is this the next Russo-Turkish war? This is what we expect to see halfway through Daniel 11 and verse 40, and we're given one sentence on it. Syria war, brutal endgame in Idlib, risks spilling over. Let me just read this to you. This is from last night. Details of what actually happened are only slowly emerging. The Turks have been at pains to blame the Syrian Air Force, though it's clear that Russian jets have very much been involved in some sort of this recent fighting. The possibility, let's put it no stronger than that, that Moscow's warplanes may have hit forces of a NATO country operating in Syria underscores the gravity of what's going on. But whatever the nationality of the aircraft involved, this seems, at least from Turkish reports, to be anything but an accidental attack. The scene is set for a full-scale confrontation between Turkey and Syria. This leaves all sorts of questions. Will Ankara or Damascus back down? Can Moscow, hardly a neutral party, in some way encourage de-escalation? And is there any way to persuade the Syrian regime to halt its wider offensive in Idlib? This appears doubtful, since Syrian President Bashar al-Assad seems intent on taking back control of the area, and the Russians have already been backing him to this end. Last night. So much so that this week they said that Turkey may close the Bosphorus to Russian warships. Now, we know that that cannot happen, because verse 40 tells us that the King of the North will come with many ships. So there's no way that the Russians will allow the Bosphorus Straits to be closed for them, for them to be able to go through. That article, let me just read to you a note that I've put in my notes that was in this article. Two Russian warships equipped with cruise missiles have passed through Istanbul's Bosphorus Strait on their way to the Syrian coast. This was yesterday. The Mediterranean, the Russian Navy's new playground. Since taking office, Putin has been intent on restoring Russia as a great world power, particularly building its ocean-going navy. Russia and Syria, in December, held their first joint naval drills. Here is the eastern leg of that empire sitting in the King of the North territory, Syria, setting up naval drills before our eyes in the last couple of months. Are we watching these things? This was sent to me by our brother Don, actually, this week. Is Putin turning the Mediterranean into a Russian lake? But all of these things are before Russia will drop, verse 41, into the glorious land, into the land of Israel. And we understand, will you turn back to Ezekiel 38? Our thoughts are being drawn to a close. Will you turn back to Ezekiel 38, please? Where we understand that this deceitful king that will come onto the mountains of Israel will come to a people who are not expecting it. A people who are dwelling safely. We read at the end of verse 8, that Israel shall dwell safely, all of them. In verse 11, we read that Gog will be told to go to the land of unwalled villages, to them that are at rest, that dwell safely, dwelling without walls, having neither bars nor gates. And we think, how can Israel possibly be dwelling safely when they see this aggressor building above them, the new king of the north? Well, in January, the Jerusalem Post reported that Putin is to receive the Friends of Zion Award in Jerusalem. We're told, aren't we, explicitly in Daniel chapter 8, that this crafty, this deceitful king, by peace, will destroy many. He's going to drop like a whirlwind, like a storm. He'll come crashing down, but they will not expect it. They will be dwelling, as far as they're concerned, safely, because they believe that the king of the north is their friend. They've honored him for being their friend. And we're also told, aren't we, that the king of the north will come down, verse 12, to take a spoil. And this spoil could be many things. We understand this, and we certainly wouldn't want to be dogmatic about what this spoil is. But it certainly makes sense, doesn't it, in the world today. And when we look at Russia today, that this spoil could well be energy. And the reason we say that is because the whole of Russia's economy is built on selling gas and oil. So if that's taken away from it, because nations go to other countries to buy gas and oil, then Russia, of all nations, will not be happy. So Russia's stance on Israeli settlements in the West Bank remains unchanged. Let me just very quickly show you this. I meant to show you this before I talked to you very quickly about the oil and gas. And that is this. We know from Ezekiel 38 that the nation of Israel are to be brought back, verse 8, after many years you'll be visited. We know that that's happened. They've been brought into the land in 1948. But we're also told that's brought back from the land, that's gathered out of many people, the king of the north will come against the mountains of Israel. Now, what is that? What are the mountains of Israel? Brother Tim has just got back from Israel with his family. He will know, as many of you who've been to Israel will know, that the mountains running south to north, north to south, the plateau, west of the River Jordan, called today not the mountains of Israel, but the West Bank. That is the territory that the king of the north, we're told, will come against. So why would Russia come against the mountains of Israel? We know they're going to come for spoil, but I don't think they'll tell the world they're coming for spoil. They'll tell the world that they need to come onto the mountains of Israel. Why? Well, we see today, don't we, this area as being such a contentious area in the land. The Palestinians believe it's their territory, and so does the rest of the world. The United Nations insist that Israel must reset its borders back to the 1967, or the borders before 67, before the Six-Day War, when Israel were able to take the mountains. They were able to take the West Bank. But of course, as Netanyahu is desperately trying to get back into power, he's saying to Israel, vote for me, vote for me. If you vote for me, I will annex all of the West Bank, the mountains of Israel. We've seen, haven't we, in the last month or so, President Trump give his strategy for the Middle East that says, yes, we think that the mountains are yours. The West Bank should be yours. But Russia And the United Nations, the rest of the world, are not happy with that. Russia's stance on Israeli settlements in the West Bank remains unchanged. Russia calls the US backing for Israeli settlements a blow to the peace process. The Russians, the Palestinians, denounce the US support for Israeli settlements. Russia, Arab nations warn Trump's settlements policy could escalate tensions and lead to dangerous consequences, which naturally are written down here, where the Palestinian president calls on other countries to declare their opposition to it. Russia slams the US decision on illegal Israeli settlements. The Russian president meet on Israeli-Palestinian situation. The EU warns Israel why the West Bank annexation can't go unchallenged. Of course they do, because they are confederate with Gog of the land of Magog, their Goma, that will come together against the mountains of Israel. EU warns will challenge Israel if the government pushes forward with annexation plans. Netanyahu announces new settlements, of course, days before the election. That's in the next few days, the Israeli election, that we need to watch carefully. He pledges to build new settler homes ahead of elections. It's so significant because Ezekiel 36 tells us that there will have been, Brother Thomas tells us, commenting on Ezekiel 36, there will have been a considerable gathering of Israelites on the mountains of Israel before the invasion of the country by Gog. So it matters. You've got to watch it. Watch the mountains. We know Ezekiel 36 sets us up with Ezekiel 38. Before Gog comes crashing, verse 8, onto the mountains of Israel, the settlements will have increased. They will increase and increase and increase. Ezekiel 36 makes clear to us, I will increase the number of people on the mountains of Israel. I will settle you, he says to Israel, on the mountains. That's why Brother Thomas was so confident to say that there'll be a population growth on the mountains. There are now nearly 750,000 Jews on the mountains of Israel, in the West Bank. And that's where Gog will come down. But we're told they will come to take a spoil. We've already considered why Russia might want to do so. Look at these headlines very quickly. An oil boom is transforming the Eastern Mediterranean and changing relationships, especially with Israel. Israel's Leviathan, which of course is the great gas field that they've got about 50 miles off their coast, off Haifa, begins pumping gas. That's December just last year, 2 months ago. The Leviathan natural gas field could be a game changer for Israel-EU relations. Look what it says. This is January the 19th. Executive summary. The vast Leviathan natural gas field off the Haifa coast could be a game changer for Israel's relations with the EU. Europe is currently dependent on Russia's natural gas. And so, of course, it goes on to explain that they could undercut that. Local and geopolitics intrude in Israel's attempt to supply Europe with gas. The article tells us, once Israeli gas begins flowing into the European Union, the relationship could soon strain as Russia's economy depends significantly on revenue from Europe. Russia's Middle Eastern strategy explained. The Jerusalem Post gave us some analysis just this last month. It's been true for decades. The Russian economy is largely the business of exporting oil and gas. And we read in the autumn that Egypt keeps finding natural gas. But what does that actually mean? Well, the New York Times, commenting early in the year, said the flood of new gas has been bad news for traditional exporters, particularly Russia. We know that the King of the North, we're told in Daniel 11, will not just come down into Israel, onto the mountains. They'll come crashing through the land. They'll want to spoil, and they'll go and they'll take over the treasuries of Egypt. Just finally, turn back to Daniel 11. We need to take note of this, brethren and sisters, and young people perhaps particularly. Because if we think that we can wait for this king to drop onto the mountains, to move into Egypt, before we commit ourselves to these things. Interested friends, look carefully at these things. We read in verse 44 that when the king of the north is sitting in Egypt, he'll hear tidings out of the east and out of the north. And brethren and sisters, we believe this to be us, don't we? Those tidings out of the east. When you go east of Egypt and you come into the Sinai Peninsula here, we believe this will be the saints as they are being prepared by the Lord Jesus Christ to move, to be ready for the battle of the great day of God Almighty, to be ready for the battle of Armageddon. So we cannot find ourselves thinking, well, I'll wait for Russia to go into Turkey, or I'll wait for them to go into the mountains, or I'll wait for them to go into Egypt. The Lord may already have come, because the dead in Christ will rise first before those of us who are alive will be gathered to join with them. And so let's think carefully on these things. We see the most extraordinary signs of the times, don't we? We know that the day is coming soon when that Russian power, Nebuchadnezzar's image, standing on its feet, will be on the mountains. And the stone cut out of the mountain without hands will smash into that image. And me and you will be part, we pray, of that stone as it breaks that image into pieces and as the kingdom begins to grow. And so we simply ask ourselves, are we prepared? The king of the north was asked to prepare. Are we prepared? Are we ready, not for the King of the North, but for the King of all the world, the Lord Jesus Christ?